Good morning and welcome to WERU. This is a special that we hope will be just the first in a series of conversations between Robert Shetterly, the local well-known artist, and the subjects of some of his portraits in the series Americans Who Tell the Truth. Rob Shetterly, as I said, is a local artist. He's very well known in this area. He has been the editorial page artist for the Maine Times newspaper. He's illustrated National Audubon's children's newspaper, Audubon Adventures, and approximately 30 books. His paintings and drawings and prints are in collections all over the United States and Europe. A collection of his drawings and etchings, Speaking Fire at Stones, was published in 1993. He's well known for his series of 70 painted etchings based on William Blake's Proverbs of Hell, and for another series of 50 painted etchings reflecting on the metaphor of the Annunciation. His painting tends toward the narrative and the surreal, and he hasn't been until this time a portrait painter. Now, many of you may be familiar with a traveling exhibition of Americans Who Tell the Truth, but for those of you who haven't had a chance to see it in our area, you can see the portraits, which all include a quote from the person who Robert Shetterly has painted, at the website americanswhotellthetruth.org. Today's audio portrait is of Hal Crowther, also a part-time resident of our area, and the quote that Robert Shetterly chose to include on his portrait of Hal Crowther was the following, quote, "Swollen corporations rule more or less unchallenged. When a big one falls as Enron fell, it's like a missing tooth in the blinding corporate smile that mesmerizes America. For a moment, anyone who cares to look can see all the infection and corruption in the hungry mouth that threatens to swallow us whole. Expect a brief glimpse before the big smile is repaired by the best oral surgeon's money can buy. But what we see, and the only way we respond to what we see, is more critical to America's survival than the fate of a million Islamic terrorists." Close quote. That's Hal Crowther. Now we join Robert Shetterly in conversation with Hal Crowther.
Well, I'm going to start this, Hal, by introducing you to the WERU audience, because I presume, probably accurately, that you're much better known in the South than you are in the North, and not so much in this area. And I'm going to read something about you, and then talk a little bit about how I got connected with you, and especially about why it was that I wanted to paint your portrait. And then I'm going to start asking your questions. So even though this is an interview, it's going to begin with an explanation of who you are, okay?
Okay.
And what I'm going to do is, there is a terrific website, just halcrowther.com, in which you can read excerpts from some of his writings as well as get links to other places and hear about his life and books.
And buy the books.
And buy the books, and of course, buy the books. But I'm going to read a little bit about that. Hal Crowther's current collection of essays, Gather at the River, a National Book Award nominee, was published by the Louisiana State University Press a year ago, September, right? Mm-hmm. For his collection, Unarmed But Dangerous, he was cited by Kirkpatrick Sale as the best essayist working in journalism today. Another book, Cathedrals of Kudzu, published in 2000, has been one of the New South's most honored and critically acclaimed works of nonfiction. It received the Lillian Smith Book Award from the Southern Regional Council, the 1999-2001 Fellowship Prize for Nonfiction from the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and the 2001 Book of the Year Award for Essays from Forward Magazine. The Southern Book Critics Circle also chose Cathedrals as a finalist for the Southern Book Award in Nonfiction. Hal Crowther, a former columnist and film and drama critic for the Buffalo News, staff writer for Time, and media critic for Newsweek, has filed his personal essays on culture, media, politics, natural history, and the unnatural humanity, and unnatural humanity from every continent except Australia and Antarctica. Hal Crowther was born March 26, 1945, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, the son of an American naval officer. He is a graduate of Williams College with a BA in English and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism class of 1967, where, by the way, he was a classmate and is a longtime friend of Molly Ivins. He launched his syndicated column in The Spectator of Raleigh, North Carolina, where he was executive editor from 1984 to 1989. His column in The Independent Weekly won the Baltimore Sun's H.L. Mencken Writing Award, the first weekly column so honored. In 1988, it won another national award, the AAN, American Association of Newsweeklies, first prize for commentary, shared with Nat Hentoff of The Village Voice. In 2000, Crowther received a career prize, the Russell J. Jandoli, is that pronounced correctly? Jandoli Award for Excellence in Journalism from St. Bonaventure University. There's a lot more here to read, but I think I'll stop there and just say how fortunate we are in this area to have Hal with us today. My connection with him began a number of years ago reading a little newspaper that comes out of Iowa called The Progressive Populist that publishes his essays on politics and culture. I was struck again and again but in reading them at how well he articulated so many of the political and cultural problems of this country. His voice was not just reporting, it was so insightful that I began to think that this is a person with a unique voice who I would like to paint a portrait of for my series of Americans Who Tell the Truth. And then a sort of curious and serendipitous thing happened. I happened to be, just a year ago, at an art opening in Castine, Maine, and was talking to a wonderfully attractive and intelligent woman named Lee Smith, and talking about her novels, and she happened to tell me that she was from the Hillsborough, North Carolina, Chapel Hill area. And that, and I stopped her and I said, "Oh my goodness, do you by any chance know a man named Hal Crowther?" and she said to me, "Oh yeah, he's standing right here, he's my husband." Lee Smith is a wonderful novelist who's actually at this moment on a book tour. So, of course, I collared Hal and told him what I wanted to do and invited him to my house, and he came over and posed for me, and I painted his portrait. And shortly after I painted his portrait, I went back and reread many, many of his political and cultural essays and picked out, I've got, I think, 7 pages here of different quotes of his that I would consider using on his portrait. And what I'm going to do is ask him about, read him some of those quotes, and then talk about some of the issues that are inherent in them. But first I want to read one that I think is sort of stands as perhaps his credo. Or maybe actually, it might be better if you read it, if you want to. This one that begins, "It's my personal conviction."
Okay.
Right down there.
Oh, I remember this, yeah, okay. This is from the introduction about the truth. Yeah. "It's my personal conviction that cruelty follows a lie, loves a lie, makes its nest in a lie. And I've never been able to divine any purpose in our individual human lives unless it's to reduce the sum of human cruelty during the time when we're alive. That's reason enough to press for the truth, to expose falsehood, even to deplore ambiguity if it's thick enough for cruelty to hide behind it. I think that liberation from truth is the same as liberation from responsibility, an open invitation to all the ugliest things that adhere to human nature."
When did you say that?
I think it's an essay about the truth. Years ago, I compared, you know, people who cared about the truth to this man in the desert somewhere in California who saved pieces of old Indian motorcycles and slowly reconstructed them year after year, you know. And I said that people who care that much about the truth, you know, are getting to be as few as the people who care that much about Indian motorcycles. But it's the same process, you know. Somebody has to do it.
Do you... was there a time in your perception of American culture when it began to strike you that the truth was more and more missing from dialogue and in our culture and in our politics?
Well, like everyone, you know, you have a kind of a slow dawning. You kind of have a gathering of insight, I guess. Some people never get there. Some people get there slowly, and some people are fairly quick to pick up on it. I came from a Republican family, a moderate Republican family, and I actually went to the right of my father because I thought he was kind of a hopeless, soft-hearted liberal chump, you know, when I was a teenager, and was a Goldwater fan for a while. There's a libertarian streak in me, kind of a, you know, get these bureaucrats away from my door Of course, I learned later that, you know, that's all about when you eliminate the government and you eliminate the police and so forth and so on, it just means that the big fish eat the little fish that much faster. But you don't know that when you're 17 years old. But I think the first time that I just saw that you know, what most people were listening to and believing was a lot of nonsense was when I was at Time Magazine and I was writing for the education section. And I was writing about Ronald Reagan and the Angela Davis case in California. And, you know, I think Reagan's problems, you know, his mental sliding began in middle age. I don't think that this is something that came on after he was president. But I kept reading. I had really no serious politics. I mean, I had gone through the occupations at Columbia and so on. I was done being a baby conservative, but I was still being formed. And all of a sudden I realized that the governor of California, one of the most powerful people in the world, was making no sense whatsoever in any of these dispatches that I had on my desk, that, you know, that he didn't actually know what racism was. In other words, he was so stupid. I don't think he thought of himself as a racist in terms of being, you know, hostile toward people of other colors or anything. It's just that he was so completely moronic that he didn't know that everything that he said was condescending and you know, and part of that old racial baggage. And I just kept writing these stories the way they struck me. In other words, to make Reagan look like he appeared to me, you know, for the readers of Time Magazine. And they kept sending it back to me changed again and again and again until all my opinion would disappear for it. And finally they published the, you know, the eighth version or something like that, which had almost all of my indignation and my insight removed. And I think that was a sort of a seminal experience.
Hmm. You were for a number of years when you were at Time and then Newsweek writing about the media and about television. And I think I got the impression from talking to you once before that that period gave you also a really strong sense of American culture and the way it was headed in terms of what advertising and TV was doing to the sort of general IQ of the nation.
I had a lot of close-up experience with television. I wish I could say I learned my lesson when I was a television critic and back in the late 60s and early 70s, but later on I did go to L.A. and write some television myself. Of course, I thought that I would write so well that I would change the entire industry and everything would go in a different direction. Like that's a real child's dream. But when you're faced with these people who create television. I mean, I'll never forget people like, you know, Michael Eisner, who ended up the head of Disney and so on. And these people were just loathsome weasels, right? It didn't take a really experienced reporter to see what was going on. And I remember my first scoop years ago, there was a guy named Freddie Silverman who was the programmer for CBS. And Freddie Silverman stood up in front of a group of people, and I asked him point blank if it was true that Carol O'Connor had quit All in the Family, which I knew he had because my friend who worked at ABC had heard it 2 days before and had called me on the phone, my fairly highly placed friend. And he just flatly lied to me. He said, no, it's not it, and there's no truth in this whatsoever. And of course, because it had been denied by the head of, you know, CBS, I didn't file the story, right? I just said, well, okay. And, of course, the whole world had it 2 days later. You know, he had suckered me. And that was just part of the game. It wasn't as if you were going to get an apology. And you were constantly inundated in this very, very suspicious atmosphere. They would take you out to Los Angeles, and they'd wine and dine you, and you'd get to, you know, ride on John Wayne's yacht, and you'd get to play golf with Bing Crosby, and that you were surrounded by attractive young women, sort of, you know, starlets and publicists, and you didn't know what they were. But you were supposed to be so dazzled that your actual opinion about these shows was completely kind of snowed under and fuzzed over. And, of course, I was always a hard sell. You know, I love the luxury, but the more they tried to you know, subvert me and coerce me, the angrier I got, and the more I think it was once described in the Columbia Journalism Review, one of my reports from California in Newsweek, it said it sounds like Kafka at a cocktail party. You know, I just got angrier and angrier, and I did have this great insight that this was really the technology that could make or more likely break the society. I just had a dreadful insight. And at that time, there was a wonderful book called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television by a man named Jerry Mander, who had been an advertising man, a Madison Avenue wizard himself. And that, along with the work of Neil Postman, you know, who called himself a media ecologist, I think, who worked at NYU, their work pretty much gave me cleaned me of television back in the 70s. I have not watched a commercial program since 1977. I mean, so I've never heard of all these programs that generations of people have grown up on. I mean, I've never seen them anyway, and I don't recognize the names of the people who starred in them. I think I wrote a piece once in the New York Times magazine saying, I will never comment on this medium again, except in sweeping generalities, you know, and I haven't.
Well, can I ask you some sweeping generalities? I mean, I think it seems to some people that, and maybe this is, you know, after the fact, but it still makes sense that the TV has, whether it was intended or not, in a sense, is been an enormous conspiracy against, you know, for dumbing down the American electorate. I mean, the American citizenry. And that we find, you know, people who are in front of TV and because of TV, you know, complacent and complicit and you know, non-thinking, non-critical. And is that, how intentional is that?
Well, the medium itself is really dangerous. I mean, that's one thing that Mander, you know, he had a lot of science in there, a lot of psychology and even neurology, you know, things that he'd picked up. And it isn't really the content. You know, I mean, obviously there are some intelligent things in television. As a matter of fact, there are probably a great many more gifted actors, writers, and so on. You know, people who make this stuff than the industry has any need for. There's a tremendous amount of talent out there, but the medium itself, it's been shown many times. It creates passivity and it creates an inability to question. And of course, it's all about advertising. And if you watch it carefully, and it's even more so now with all these reality shows and so on, the commercials are the places where all the talent is, where all the calculation. I mean, the shows are just patched together. They're just, you know, they're just filler. The shows are just something to get you from one of these beautifully crafted commercials from one to the other. And as the years go by, and they realize that they can hold people's attention with less and less actual skill and care, the programming goes down and down and down. But it's just the way capitalism works. You know, at first you go out with your product and you try to seduce people, and maybe you even try to seduce them by having a better product and more quality than the next person. But what you're looking for, if you're an honest and evil capitalist, is you're looking for a formula that will take all the guesswork out of it. And that's pretty much what's happened. It isn't like an open conspiracy to sit down and say, well, these people are really stupid. We can sell them anything. Let's do this. Let's do that. What it is trying to get a formula so that fewer and fewer shows will fail and more. The risk factor is more or less eliminated. And the way that you can sell people things in television is just becoming, you know, as each generation watches more than the one before, it's become almost an automatic thing. You can just sort of plug it into the wall and guarantee so many million viewers and so many million sales and hits on sites and so on. It's alarming. It's an alarming technology. E.B. White, I know I put in a couple of essays. E.B. White said back in 1938 that TV would determine what would happen to the United States of America. And now some of these studies show what kids watch 6, 7, 8 hours a day. I mean, you know, they have to go to school. They have to sleep. What does that leave? And actually they're becoming hideously obese.
Well, that problem of the techniques and the seduction of capitalism, is it – well, I want to ask a question here about democracy and capitalism. It seems that there's perhaps a kind of incompatibility between the two, and that one has replaced the other. And has that happened? You know, is television and the media one of the big ways that that's happened? I mean, how has that been sold to the American people, and why have they, we accepted it so easily.
Well, apparently television gave the hucksters, you know, whether they were politicians or salesmen, it gave them a tool so powerful they probably had no idea originally what they had. We turned it over to them also. I mean, we could have done a lot of different things and just turned it over to the capitalist who, you know, was making the highest bid. But we turned it over to the hucksters, and it turned out to be so much more technology than they imagined. It's a kind of mind control. I mean, I don't ever watch television except major sporting events. So I'm not used to commercials breaking the thread of my concentration. I'm just amazed and offended. I can't, oh my God, you know, you can't. Unless every once in a while you'll watch an old movie, you know, they give you 7 minutes or something, and they'll throw in another commercial. And I'm jumping out of my seat with indignation. But, of course, the vast audience has been so inured to this that they could probably run a commercial every 2.5 minutes, and they wouldn't be offended. Mm-hmm. What they've done is they've basically altered the rhythm of people's minds and the way they respond to narratives, I believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's serious long-term damage to people's attention span. And their ability, their reading, you know, their comprehension even, that's been done by this chopped up thing that cuts in two directions, whereas at one point they're supposedly trying to tell you a story, and on the other hand, they're trying to sell you something. And I don't know if you've noticed, I picked this up when some friends came to visit me this summer, and they were great fans of a couple of those soap operas on HBO, which are written by, you know, really brilliant people and well-performed and but they're soap operas, and if you haven't watched them before, they don't make any sense. And the whole thing is sewed together now, even by the people that don't do commercials like HBO. The idea is to grab you and hold you forever, and you can't just come in the middle. They're all that way now. They leave you hanging at the end of the – that is a kind of a conspiracy. They're getting better and better and better at what they do.
Hmm. Well, I want to read for people the quote that I actually put on your painting, which sort of touches on this subject but also broadens it out to in terms of the war on terrorism and contemporary political history. This was, you can tell me, I didn't, when I wrote all these quotes down, I didn't keep a record of just which essays they were from, but this is the one I chose. Swollen corporations rule more or less unchallenged. When a big one falls as Enron fell, it's like a missing tooth in the blinding corporate smile that mesmerizes America. For a moment, anyone who cares to look can see all the infection and corruption in the hungry mouth that threatens to swallow us whole. Expect a brief glimpse before the big smile is repaired by the best oral surgeons money can buy. But what we see and the way we respond to what we see is more critical to America's survival than the fate of a million Islamic terrorists.
I like that. That's well written.
Very well written. Enlarge it a little bit.
Well, I have a daughter who's pregnant now, right? And I have a stepson who has a wife who's pregnant. And so more, you know, children are coming into the world. And I say terribly depressing things to them, like, well, how can you have a child and then turn that child loose in this particular culture? You know, I mean, how – because it's geared basically to turn people into perfect consumers, perfect employees, perfect sheep-like voters for the rest of their lives. And, I mean, people like Roger Ailes, for instance, you know, who runs Fox Television, it isn't so much interesting that, of course, he is a right-winger and he worked for all the Republican presidents and so on and never was a journalist at any time in his life. But he also worked for Rush Limbaugh. He worked for Pepsi-Cola. I mean, this is a man who was a part of that establishment that's trying to basically brainwash an entire population from the ground up. And there was an article in the paper this morning that talked about the number of junk food messages that are included in small children's television. I don't know if you saw that, but since I don't watch it, I'm not aware of these things. But apparently even on public television, there's these constant messages from people who are supposedly in support of free people's television and so on, constantly having Ronald McDonald jump up and smile and so on. And they know the McDonald's jingle by the time they're 2.5 or 3 years old. Now, this this is a kind of a conspiracy. I mean, this is a place where people with these skills, like Roger Ailes and so on, are trying to do something with the entire population. And if I had a child, it's not such a joke. I have a good friend, a writer, who got divorced about 5 years ago and now has a new wife and three children under four. So I mean, so he's actually going to have to go through with this and go through this whole decision-making thing in his 60s. But are you just going to turn them over? Are you going to let them watch these things? And you can't really stop them. You turn and you have all the computers. They're computer literate by the time they're five or six. You have people feeding them to predators. And I don't – you know, it's just the whole business is – I would not raise a child in this culture at this moment. And the only way you can get around it, of course, is if you had so much money that you can afford to take him off on a boat somewhere and, you know, and homeschool him. Or, you know, send them to school in Switzerland or someplace or Sweden. But basically, if you're going to have your child in this culture, the child is going to want to do what his peers do. And there you're dead. You're going to become the child's enemy or you're going to give in.
Well, I think, you know, implicit in what you're saying is the question, well, if this is where we're going and it's a terrible place to, well, to be in already or keep heading deeper into. How do we change direction? I mean, where is that going to come from? I mean, how do – well, that's the question.
Well, that's the great question. Yeah. Of course, I mean, I always say, well, I can tell you what's wrong, but I'm not the man who has the answers to how to fix it. But obviously, it's education from the lowest level, from, you know, preschool on up. There have to be an awful lot of people dedicated – family by family, not just family by family, community by community, to teaching these children differently, you know, to get them out of this mainstream business of being perfect consumers and so on and get take them back to basic values and independence. I think, you know, my father, whom I fought with all the time, and, you know, I think someone once said that probably my whole career was based on the fact that I kept on arguing after my father died. You know, the argument wasn't over, right? I mean, I just kept on making my points. But my father taught me one thing, and he didn't even mean it quite that way. But he just said, never accept any authority. He said, never, you know, have no heroes, have no gurus, you know, join nothing. I've never joined anything. I'm the last person. I've never joined a political party or much of it. But he taught me that. And what he meant, of course, the joke joker in the deck was that he meant accept me, you know, accept no authority except me. And, of course, at the point when I rejected him, I didn't have anybody left. But, I mean, that's the one thing that I did learn. And I don't know that many of these young people now are getting that. I don't know if they're getting that idea that the only thing that's worth anything is your own brain, well informed, you know, and seasoned to deal with these things one at a time. There's no package, there's no system, there's no party, there's no ideology that's going to take you from point A to point B. I mean, you just have to dig in and be a serious citizen. And someone's going to have to teach these people that.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned parties, and I remember in one of these other quotes that I wrote down, you said, I believe that the split between liberal and conservative, Democrat or Republican, is inconsequential compared to the real fracture line between Americans who try to think clearly and those who will not or cannot. That seems to be precisely what you're saying, but mm-hmm. I want to also ask just a question about parties and the party structure. What is it that has gotten us to this point where our you know, even though we say we have two parties and then we have a couple of fringe parties, that they really, I think an awful lot of Americans feel that they're not represented by anybody in any party.
Well, money is a tremendous problem. Of course, that man just spent $4 million of his own money. God, I hope it was only four. Maybe it was 40 or something, you know, in the Lieberman race, that Lamont. I mean, in other words, to be a United States senator, you either have to have, you know, friends or supporters of some kind for some reason, for some agenda, pour some enormous fortune, you know, into your chest, or you have to be a multimillionaire to participate in politics, you know, at the national level. And that, of course, eliminates 99% of people right there. And if you begin to accept money, which you have to, from various kinds of people, by the time you achieve power, you're already compromised 100 ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are all kinds of people, young people, lawyers and so on, who mean really well, who start out in politics with all kinds of idealism. I've known a lot of people like that. But by the time they get to the point where they could actually make a difference, where they actually could theoretically have some power of their own, they've been sold 100 different ways, and they don't even understand all the ways that they've been sold. But the you know, the money that it takes to maintain, to keep getting reelected, you know, that's one of the most terrifying scandals, and one that obviously involves Democrats as well as Republicans, the fact that you just cannot get rid of an incumbent. And 90% of that is money. And television and media, the fact that the media can take just any sow's ear and make people who aren't very perceptive think it's a silk purse. You know, these people have enormous skills. Basically, the people, I mean, good reporters, say, you know, honest reporters, there are still a few media organizations that try, you know, that make an effort. But, I mean, these people are not up to the skills when it comes to persuasion, when it comes to, you know, argument among the people, when it comes to debate. They're not up to the skills of the devils on the other side. So, I mean, these devils are full of genius. You look at a journalism school now, and many of the best students, I'm not saying all journalism schools are the same, I'm saying that all the best students, but basically the top of the class ends up in some form of advertising or corporate public relations. This is where the creme de la creme, the people who are intellectually agile, end up. And the people who are either tremendously idealistic, of which there are only a few, or the people who just aren't quite good enough for Madison Avenue and Roger Ailes and so forth, they end up manning the small town papers and so on and trying to keep up with these wizards on the other side. Mm. And they're losing the battle.
Well, again, I guess the question comes, you know, they're losing the battle, and the problem is so – I guess I look at it this way. You know, it's one thing to be a very perceptive critic of the culture, as you are, and then to look at the scale of the problems that are coming at us in terms of global warming and energy depletion and habitat loss and water and species extinction and, you know, you name it. They're coming at us like freight trains, and only people who are willing to tell the truth are going to be able to deal with those problems in a way that may or may not make life somewhat sustainable. So a great will is going to be required amongst some people to get the money out of politics and change our media, etc. Where is that will going to come from, or is it? Are we too embedded in the kind of culture that we have at this moment to even hope that we can do that?
Well, we have two big problems in this country. One of them is this long-term thing that we're talking about, where, you know, people have sort of given their lives over to mass media and to, you know, some sort of electronic hive life, if you will. Which I think that's not original. I think that's a book by what's his name? Sven Burkert's, an excellent book by Sven Burkert's on the internet and so on. But I mean, just, you know, giving yourself over to hive life, and that's a long term dangerous thing, which I think is turning out bad citizens and sort of, you know, hopeless conformists. It's also just kind of clogging up people's minds. I mean, people, you know, who are communicating 24 hours a day, barking into these cell phones and dashing back and forth with 500 email messages and so on. Those minds are being eroded. You know, I mean, people need to sit on the end of the dock and think and watch, you know, watch the gulls and, you know, and the loons and so on once in a while. You just can't have messages from other human beings pouring into your brain 24 hours a day. And some of these young people, they talk about multitasking, but unless they're a complete different species from me, I think something is being lost there. But we have the one problem is the long range. Subversion, I think, of citizenship, of selective, thoughtful citizenship by this corporate you could call it a conspiracy. But the other thing is just what happened to us in the year 2000, that we happened to possibly with a fixed election. It's quite possible. I think a lot of people, even the New York Times, I think finally declared that if Gore had stuck it out, he probably would have won. And this, the people we got were so bad. I mean, I honestly believe after avoiding saying this for a couple of years because it just sounded a little too radical, I really do believe that these people mostly work for the petroleum industry. I honestly do. I mean, they actually did, you know. I mean, they all did at one time or another, even Condoleezza Rice. But, I mean, you hate to say that. You think, well, they had other interests. They did other things. But, I mean, I think what we did in the year 2000, either through bad luck or through actual theft and criminality, we came to a group of people so totally controlled by a certain kind of corporate will that it may, in the long run, I don't know. I mean, nothing could be more horrible than the trillions of dollars we're spending and the people that are dying for no reason in the Middle East. But they are so bad that it may create some kind of a reaction that wouldn't have occurred otherwise. I mean, I noticed just about 2 years into the Bush administration, and I had no idea, I mean, that Bush was this bad. I knew people that grew up with him in West Texas and so on. And I thought he was some sort of a cookie-cutter, low IQ, country club moderate. I really did. I mean, because I knew some of the people, you know, that he knew and so on. I had no idea. And after 2 years, the lies and the right wing policies and the crazy people they were bringing back from all the other failed administrations, I mean, people who'd been indicted and humiliated and basic pariahs, you know, like Richard Perle, and so they were all reappearing. Point Dexter, you remember that group? The whole bunch that were involved in Central America.
Elliot Abrams.
Elliot Abrams. All of them. I mean, I thought these guys were on Devil's Island or something. And the next thing you knew, they were back in the government. They were back on Fox Television. And all of a sudden, I realized that just simply, even quietly, telling the truth made me sound like the liberal equivalent of Rush Limbaugh because they were so bad, you know. And they've been done nothing but get worse and worse and worse. And, you know, that's one of the few small possibilities that I see. I see a group of people who were basically passive, who basically took very little interest in politics or in being good citizens, who maybe are waking up, are feeling some outrage. And that's one thing that we might be able to hope for. We will see in this election. I mean, if a party that controls both houses of Congress and the White House can lie and screw up and harm people the way this one has and still win the midterm election, I'd say we were lost.
Well, it seems to me that just looking at the Military Commission Act, which was passed last week, I mean, if that this is has to do with the treatment of detainees and what and the definition of what a non-combatant, I mean a military, I can't think of the word right now, basically what a terrorist is,
right,
and who they are. I mean, if that goes by without significant outrage from this country, where basically
a terrorist is a freedom fighter who disagrees with you.
Exactly. But I mean the loss of habeas corpus, keeping detainees, being able to indict them and even execute them on the basis of hearsay evidence, all that sort of stuff, allowing it to be retroactive in terms of the immunity, mm-hmm. which would mean that Bush and Cheney and all those people could never be charged for war crimes. If this kind of outrage, where we've lost our constitutional democracy, if that goes by, then what? I mean,
well, that's important, you know, to people like you and me. But is it important to some of these people buried in the heart of, you know, the mass media establishment, in the heart of the hive, if you will? I don't know. We will see. I mean, do they think about their rights? Do they care about their rights? There was this it's in one of the essays I wrote a couple of years ago, and it got me on MSNBC. There was a young man, 23-year-old man, reading an essay of mine in a coffee shop in Atlanta, and he was actually a graduate of Vanderbilt University and a stringer for Time magazine. He was dressed in a manner that somebody thought looked suspicious. He was a Jewish guy, you know, curly hair, had a beard, etc. He looked like a terrorist to somebody, and two FBI agents showed up on his mother's porch looking for him that night. And he had to go downtown. And, you know, luckily his father was a lawyer. You know, he's a journalist and so forth. So, you know, nothing happened to this guy. But, I mean, imagine that it had been just some innocent guy who looked wrong to somebody in a Caribou coffee shop in Atlanta. Somebody's, I mean, there were stories. I have some things I've written, but I can't reproduce them perfectly. There are stories about totally innocent people after 911 who were just whisked away and disappeared for months on end, charged with nothing. Right. And, of course, you know about the guy in Canada who was taken to Syria and tortured, a man who had no involvement whatsoever of any kind. It's very frightening. But these are the things that don't involve people until they touch them directly. You don't know who's going to be next. You don't know, I mean, you know, someone, you know, like you or me who speaks up, you know, and who makes ourselves flagrant in the eyes of the government. I mean, all of a sudden, are things going to happen with our income taxes and so on? I mean, we know that these things happen. It happens slowly, but what was that business in Atlanta? And it's just like, you know, I think there's somewhere my grandmother used to have it on her. I'm not sure who wrote it. It wasn't Sartre, but it was a Frenchman, something like that. When they came for the Jews, I did nothing, et cetera, da, 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 and finally they came for me. You've seen that somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's something that liberals have on their refrigerators. But I mean, it's one of the great truths. Uh-huh. You know,
I want to ask you something about church and state. I think as much as we talk about the division in this country, or the supposed division, I think people are a little confused about it in a way, about what it's really supposed to mean and how the separation is supposed to work, because we have often had significant and good leaders who have professed a great faith and seem to take those values into their decision making, and then we see what seems to be the great abuse of that too. And I'll just read a quote again from one of your essays. You said, "If you could pull the shades of the founding fathers, you'd be hard pressed to find one who believed in the virgin birth. What they all believed in passionately and believed to be the cornerstone of democracy was the strictest separation of church and state." Quote, "What have been its fruits," asked James Madison, "of state-supported Christianity? More or less, in most places, pride and indolence in the clergy, ignorance and servility in the laity, in both superstition, bigotry, and persecution."
Well, the founders were all people who would be absolutely horrified by this, you know, sort of religious politicking that's going on today. At some point, again, it's just that these people who control us, who are actually in power in this country now, they discovered that there are blocks of votes available among these people whom I think of sort of as the American Taliban. But I know some of them are not actively evil, just sort of actively ignorant. But they found out that by playing up the church business to these people like Jerry Falwell and so on in his group, that you could get not a vote here, not a vote there, but a whole block of votes of people who believed that you were going to go to the White House or go to the Congress and enact these laws that interfere with other people's lives in line with their religious beliefs. And this is, unfortunately, we have a large number of these Christian Taliban types in this country. And it turned out to be just a place where the corporate party, which is now mostly the Republican Party, could go for votes. And it's an ingenious coalition. You know that, I mean, these people have nothing in common. You know, the Wall Street people who pay for the Republican Party could care less about gay marriage or abortion or any of that business, school prayer or the desecration of the flag. I mean, you really think that the head of Citicorp is worrying about someone desecrating the flag? But it's an ingenious thing for these people to go out and say, well, there are blocks of voters out there. And all of this would just drive Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and so on just mad with indignation. I mean, the whole idea, you know, in those days was that religion, if it wasn't actively evil, which a lot of people during the Enlightenment became to think of it as actively evil, that it was something that was absolutely personal, that you never shared your deepest religious beliefs with anyone, that a gentleman kept it as secret as his sexuality, you know, which is not something that you talked about in public. And the kind of politics that we see now where you go fishing, you know, for people with your own piety, that would just appall them, one and all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you often find people who seem either confused or are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to perhaps not the head of Citicorp, but maybe to George Bush about his religious beliefs, is that maybe the guy really believes this stuff. I mean, maybe he believes that God speaks to him. Maybe he believes that, you know, he's a real born again with actually a sincere Christian belief. Other people, I think that you're an idiot to believe something, that he believes that stuff, that it's all cynicism. What do you think about that?
I have friends who believe that he's an authentic, born again, reformed alcoholic, et cetera, et cetera. Narcotics Anonymous, the various things that he did. I also know some people who knew him back when he was one of the most worthless people in the state of Texas. But that's another story. I mean, one of the few people who went straight from chronic unemployment to being the governor of Texas and then the president of the United States. I mean, just the man hasn't had no resume. Whatsoever. But as to whether he's sincere, I think there's room for debate. I think you have to think, what, the Yale class of 1968. I don't know how many people were in that class, but several thousand people. And only one of them says that at certain times in his life he doubts evolution. Only one. And he's the president of the United States, right? And you have to judge people by their actions. You know, we can't know whether he's incredibly stupid, incredibly cynical, or crazy. I mean, that we can't know. We just have to go on his actions and his speech, and we have to, if we could, we really have to impeach him as quickly as we can.
There's an article in the current Progressive Populist called "The Return of the Sheriff of Nottingham," and well, actually, before I read something from it, I would ask you to just tell us a little bit about what that article's about.
Well, it's about economic justice and how, we sort of subtly have morphed from a country whose heart was always sort of with the common man, and the underdog. I mean, this was a country where everybody had a chance, right? I mean, the immigrants came in and you came over from the old country and you made your way, and that's our myth. That's our myth. Of course, you don't mention slavery, you don't mention exterminating the Indians, et cetera, but we have this nice myth that worked for a lot of people. And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden. I mean, it's gone up and down, but of course the Depression had a lot to do with it. But I mean, today, meaning all of a sudden the 21st century, it's as if all that sort of populist rhetoric and populist politics and so on has become restricted to a very small minority. And at one time, it was almost universal. And that's one of the things I tried to point out. I threw a little history into that essay. The fact that, 100 years ago, Wall Street and, the great railroad barons and the oil companies and so on were just as powerful as ever. But every politician in both parties at least pretended to be their enemy and on the side of the common Joe. And then you've got, Senator Frist trying to attach, a bill that will take away taxes on the states over, I don't know how many million dollars, on the same bill as the minimum wage, which they're hesitant to kick from $5 to $7 an hour. And the cynicism is sort of astonishing. And people didn't run out in the streets with effigies of Senator Frist. I mean, it's people like me who say, my God, are you serious, man? But I mean, we have changed our mythology in this country in a subtle way. You take a complete idiot like Donald Trump, a man with no class, no education, no articulation, a loathsome man. I mean, who managed to increase a great fortune that his father left him pretends to be one of the world's cleverest businessmen. Some businessmen say that if you kind of stripped away the crap, that he's basically bankrupt and has been for years and years. But this man was the biggest joke in New York City when I was working there 30 years ago. I mean, he was one of those people every comedian at every club, every smart aleck, in every bar, he was the butt of every joke in New York. And somehow society has moved around to where people like this are not only successful, but they play this grand role and have sycophants, and people are supposed to respect them. for their grand numbers on their personal fortunes. And this is a new thing. This is a dangerous thing. And I don't know if that comes from 30 or 40 years of corporations controlling these mass media mind machines, you know, that all of a sudden the people that used to be the enemy of the people are now, you know, the savants, the wise fathers of us all. And that's a great change. And that's what I was trying to point out, the difference between you know, Robin Hood, who was, you know, breaking the law, but who was the friend of the poor man, and the evil sheriff of Nottingham, who was always trying to track him down and hang him. And it's as if in this country now, instead, we've gotten rid of Robin Hood and we worship the sheriff of Nottingham, who I think I compared to Dick Cheney.
You did. I want to read just a couple lines from that essay. Because it again asks the question that I was asking several times about, well, okay, what next? You said, how did it come to this in a nation that boasts so hypocritically of exporting and fighting for democracy and freedom? And we have no one in sight who promises to fight legally or illegally for economic justice. No Robin Hood, no Roosevelts, no James F. Kerry or Eugene V. Debs or William Jennings Bryan, no Fighting Bob La Follette, no Norman Thomas or Henry Wallace, no Kennedy brothers even. I guess the question for me is, you know, is it that these people really don't exist? I mean, there aren't people out there who are willing to fight that fight and resist in a big way, or is it because of the structure that has been formed in terms of media and power and corporate and political forces that those people can't get any traction?
If they indeed out there, if there are people, you know, with charisma and with original ideas, who would carry that torch, you know, and stand up for the underdog, if you will, to simplify it, they have been so marginalized by the media and the big money behind the media that they don't seem to get any traction with voters anymore. There are no longer – I mean, what I wanted to point out with some of those people, they had enormous numbers of voters behind them. You know, people like Henry Wallace and Norman Thomas and Bob La Follette and some of those Midwestern populists. I mean, these are people who, you know, who some of them were more hypocritical and more demagogical than others. Some were totally sincere and some were doing it for their own reasons. But, I mean, these were people who came out in virtually in overalls, you know, with a pitchfork and talked about the common man and getting even with Jay Gould and, you know, and J.P. Morgan. I mean, that was rhetoric that sold. It's sold everywhere, and it doesn't sell anymore. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't people. Obviously, there are people with the right ideas, but they have been marginalized. I mean, well, even, you know, in journalism, you know, if you reach a certain age and you won't take assignments from other people anymore, and you won't moderate what you say to suit the editorial page or to suit the editors of that particular publication, you have to cast your stuff pretty far out on the water to know where it's going to be published. You know, I mean, I've spent years and years just finding the right editor here and there and everywhere. You know, I think I syndicated up to, I don't know, 140 papers or something at one time. But George Will's got 500. George Will hasn't said anything worth reading since 1976, you know, not since his party was in the minority. I mean, he just blithers, and he isn't even writing well anymore. But he's got 600 papers, and the papers all divided up into, you know, here's the right guy on the right over here, and here's the left over here, and here's the clever woman, and here's the black person, da-da-da. And it's all a formula, and anyone who doesn't want to go along with it is marginalized. And it's true in politics and in journalism as well. I mean, I wrote a piece about Bill Moyers, whom I know and whom I had a chance to talk to this spring. Moyers is now he's out there in America. You know, he's a freelancer. He's been cut adrift. He's not wanted by the networks. He's not wanted by public television. He's been marked by that guy Tomlinson, that dreadful guy who got caught in something crooked almost immediately after he left public television. But I can't remember exactly what he did. There's so many scandals now. But, I mean, basically, there's a guy, one of the best journalists, the best broadcast journalists of his generation. I mean, there's one of my heroes, if I try not to have heroes. But I think Moyers is intelligent and has an enormous amount of integrity and balance and just is one of the few people in that business, in the broadcasting business who is worthy of real admiration. And he's been marginalized. And Dan Rather, who is nowhere near that upstanding and honest and fight and you know and fighting for the underdog, he also was purged for a story that basically was not even wrong. And then there was the guy, what, at C-SPAN, who lost his – the president of C-SPAN said something at Davos and lost his job. I mean, the people are being purged. I mean, this is going on. The power is the people in power are willing to do this. They're willing to go after individuals. And they have absolutely no scruples whatsoever. When you're talking about Karl Rove, you're talking about people who will do anything. I mean, that's the man who attacked the person who'd been had three Max Cleland, who three limbs had been amputated from Vietnam, and something went after him as a pinko, as soft on war, and just you know. I mean, these people will do absolutely anything.
We're getting to the end of our time here, so I know that one of the things that also besides writing about politics and culture, you know, you write about art and literature and writing a lot. And just quickly, do you find the same sort of diminishment in our culture in those spheres that you do in the political sphere?
Well, you feel the pressure. I'm particularly fond, interested in painting. You know, I'm a gallery rat, a museum rat. And you know, I don't have the equivalent of a real art education, but for a layman, I'm pretty knowledgeable. And the way the funding is going in this country now, you know, I mean, people, the pressure on orchestras and chamber music groups and theaters and so on, the government is trying to marginalize all these places where the voices, you know, independent voices, find a place, and you know, and it's slowly drying up a whole tradition of creativity. I think. I mean, there are plenty of gifted artists, but the point is, how will their work come out? Mm-hmm. I think in Broadway now they do nothing but musicals from the 50s, right? So the future, as everyone knows, the future of the theater is in little theater. It's in regional theater. It's in people doing good work in, you know, in Seattle and Dubuque and so on, and maybe someday it'll get off Broadway, but that's where the theater's going. And that's where all the arts are going to end up. It's going to be grassroots or it's going to be nothing.
Well, on that note, Al Crowther, I want to thank you.
I enjoyed it. This is great. I feel that I have no enemies in this particular studio.
I remember
saying, you know, something about Reagan once, and I looked, and the engineer was giving me a finger through the window, you know, from the other side. I feel safe here.
Well, that's good. Thank you very much for
visiting. Thank you very much.
And
enjoyed
I it. Would remind anyone who's listening to, please go to the Progressive Populist or his website or find his books in your independent bookstores and read them. You just heard an authentic voice. Thanks, Al.
Thank you very much, Rob.
You've been listening to a WERU special, and that was Brooksville artist Robert Shetterly interviewing Hal Crowther. For more information about Shetterly's portrait series, Americans Who Tell the Truth, you can go to his website, americanswhotellthetruth.org. Thanks for listening to your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. The voice of many voices.